So start out and introduce yourself. Tell me who you are and what you do.
Sure. My name's Les Roberts. Once upon a time, I was a high school physics teacher, and I made the either great mover mistake of going to Africa and seeing women carrying water unbelievable distances, and I decided that teaching young kids physics was not what was really important in life. So I went to public health school for a long time, and somehow that led to providing water services to refugees. And somehow, once you start dealing with refugees, the issue of life and death becomes pretty common and important. And over the last 20 years, I've veered from being a water engineer to someone who mostly documents human hardship and death.
So how is it that you became involved with doing some key mortality studies, is that right,
mm-hmm.
on Iraq, on the citizens of Iraq?
When the war in Iraq began, I think I had worked in 6 or 7 really hot war zones. Bosnia, Rwanda during their genocide, Armenia when they had their war with over Nagorno-Karabakh. And I think in none of those wars except Bosnia, had bullets and bombs killed more people than the indirect causes of war. In the American Civil War, more soldiers died of disease than died of bullets. And it just happens when war comes along that all the fabric of society disintegrates. And generally, you don't have new exotic diseases. You have the same things that were killing people before start killing at a higher rate. And so I was struck that by the end of 2003, the beginning of 2004, a year into the occupation, there was no discussion in the American media about Iraqi suffering. And it just seemed to me, all this bombing, all this strife, it must be that water systems aren't working, that people can't go to the hospitals and they're delivering babies at home. And I thought it would be worthwhile to go look at essentially the indirect consequences that cause death in Iraq. So I went off thinking that I wasn't really looking at violence and bombs and what soldiers did. And we were quite surprised with what we found. And we actually probably would have done a different study had we known that in Iraq violence was the main killer. I talked to a friend who had worked in Iraq for a lot of years. He had worked for the United Nations trying to document the effects of sanctions. And he put me in contact with a professor, and eventually we agreed, the professor and I, that we would do this. And so I flew to Jordan, stuffed about $20,000 into my shoes and money belt, hired someone to smuggle me into Iraq, and through a harrowing set of circumstances. I think the fellow who smuggled me had no idea how stupid it was to try to carry an American across the border there in western Iraq. I got into Baghdad, and I and this professor employed a series of his former doctorate students. So they're all doctors, and they're all his graduate students. So they had quite a bond with him and an intense loyalty to him. He's a bit of a charismatic fellow. And we went out, and in 2004, in September of 2004, took a random sample across the whole country, knocking on doors picked at random, and then asking only a couple of questions. How many people lived here at the beginning of 2002, January 1, 2002? So that was about 14 months before the invasion. How many people lived here today? That's 18 months after the invasion. And had anyone been born and anyone died? If someone had died, we said, well, how did they die? When did they die? What were the circumstances? If it was a violent death, we wrote a little narrative describing how they died. And if at the end of the interview someone had described a death, we asked for a death certificate just to make sure people weren't lying to us or saying it was a car accident when really it was militias that had killed their husband, that sort of thing. And most of the time, people had the death certificates. Not all, but 3/4 of the time that first time around, people had death certificates to confirm what they had said. And whatever people had said, every circumstance, the death certificate said the same thing. So we never found evidence people were lying. We've got a nice situation here because we're now comparing every household to itself a year before the invasion and a year and a half after the invasion. And thus, our calculation of increased death is compared to the last year of Saddam's reign. So we're saying these are deaths, not just total deaths, but deaths above the level that had happened before the invasion occurred. And thus we, in public health, generally consider it fair game to say, okay, these are deaths caused by the invasion. If an event in time occurs, the mortality goes up, we consider everything above that baseline that it was there before to be excess deaths. That first time around, we thought that about 60,000 violent deaths had occurred in that first 18 months. Shockingly to us, mostly from coalition airstrikes. That was not at all what we expected. And that there was a total of about 100,000 extra deaths, maybe slightly more. And the data was pretty crude. The result had a very wide confidence interval, as we say in statistics, around the estimate. And there was a lot of skepticism in this country. Got almost no coverage. It got a lot of coverage in Europe. It got a lot of coverage in the Middle East. And suddenly the 100,000 number was just the standard component of the dialogue in the Middle East when people were talking about the war. And then we, 2 years later, essentially repeated the same process, same investigator on the ground, mostly the same interviewers. I didn't go, but they didn't need me. We had sort of done it once together, and they had a system down. And my colleague Gil Burnham at Johns Hopkins went to Jordan and sort of sat down with the point person in Iraq, and they went over exactly how they're going to do it, and they had a questionnaire, and they went over it, and they had a plan, and my colleague Gil Burnham gave him a little cash to pay for cars and interviewers and all that. And back he went into Iraq and repeated our survey. And that time we thought that over 600,000 people had died. And this time we're pretty darn sure it's more than 400,000. And so the range of imprecision, while great, was from appallingly bad to appallingly bad. And interestingly, this time around it got a lot more press attention. I think it's because the American public had turned against the war. It made it easier for the press to say really bad things are happening in Iraq. In 2004, I think the American people were so grateful to American soldiers for the sacrifices they were making that it was hard to say, oh, bad things are happening on the ground in Iraq, and bad things are happening at the hands of our lads and gals in Iraq. But by 2006, public sentiment had turned, and so coverage was very, very different. There were a few folks, mostly political scientists and not public health people, that quibbled about aspects of the study, but months and months and months, now we're 2 years on, it's taken a lot of beating, but the couple reviews that have looked at all the evidence have consistently concluded that the Lancet study is the most robust and reasonable of those produced to date. And I should also say that of the, let's say, three estimates that have been made since 2006 by some scientific method, the lowest one is over 400,000. And the highest one was done just about a year ago by a British polling firm, would put it now just over 1 million. And those three numbers actually aren't all that inconsistent because they were done at different moments in time with different people and different methods. And so, you know, whether it's 400,000 or 1 million, I think for the American people, that shouldn't matter. What should matter is we should step back and decide, was this preemptive war a good idea? Does having 1 in 7 households, 1 in 5 households lose someone, having lost someone to violence in Iraq, does that make any policy implications for us moving forward in terms of people's attitudes about the Americans, how welcome we're going to be, whether we should have a long-term basis there? I would think that should enter into the dialogue, but it's not. And then perhaps less importantly, when General Petraeus goes and testifies before Congress, as he did in January or February this year, and says that the rate of death in Iraq, the violent death, rate of murder in Iraq, is lower than the rate in Baltimore, should we A, think that he's spinning it? Should we B, think that he doesn't know what's going on in Iraq? Or C, should we think that we need to move our troops to Baltimore because that's the more violent place that needs them? Science should be entering into our decision-making when we hear reports that the surge is working with data that's completely implausible. Completely implausible. And then the final thing that I think is most important for the average American thinking about, okay, well, how many people died in Iraq and is it important, is for President Bush to essentially never be asked by the press about this subject, for the one time he was asked in the end of 2005 and say, well, I think more or less 30,000 had died, because that was the number that had been recorded when you tally up all the newspaper reports in the West. At a time when it had to have been 10 times more or higher. Is that the tone of contrition we should be striking, given how much misery and unhappiness has unfolded in Iraq? I think all of us have had someone be irrationally optimistic and give us bad advice or do something wrong towards us. They were irrationally optimistic about whether they could get through the green light or the yellow light, and they get hit by a car and you break your leg. Or they're irrationally optimistic. You've gone to graduate school and your advisor says, oh yeah, I think being a dual ceramics math science major is going to be easy and really cool and you should do it. You know, 2 years later they spend all their tuition money, no one will talk to them, they're suicidal. When someone through insane optimism misguides us or does us wrong, the thing we expect from them is contrition. We don't expect them to say, wow, I was really stupid to try to get you to be a dual major. We expect them to say, I'm sorry this happened. I'm sorry that you're experiencing something bad. And contrition's a lot lighter than saying I was wrong. It doesn't require the same self-flagellation, but it's important. And when someone is belligerent and they've misled us, we get pretty bitter about it. And when people in Israel hear President Ahmadinejad downplay the Holocaust, they get pretty furious. When President Bush downplays the number of dead in Iraq by a factor of 10, he is doing exactly the same thing to 1.5 billion people who are Muslims in the world. And I don't think that's the right thing to be doing at this moment in our nation's history.
You had said with your first study that you had expected the numbers. You were surprised by the large numbers?
Not so much by the numbers. We just didn't think violence was going to be the main cause of death. And most importantly, it never occurred to us airstrikes from coalition forces and artillery would be the main cause of death. If you had been listening to National Public Radio or reading one of those extreme right-wing rags like the New York Times back in 2004, you would have thought there were more car bombs and roadside explosives going off than there were bombs from our planes. That's not just wrong. That's probably wrong by a factor of 10. But everyone that is reporting there is either physically embedded or mechanistically embedded because they're living in a small circle of protected hotels, or they're getting their information in the green zone, and it's coming to them through a couple of official channels, coalition spokespeople, government spokespeople. There wasn't a lot of ground truthing once you get outside of Baghdad going on, and the bombing wasn't going on in Baghdad. It was going on when fighting would start in Ramadi or Najaf or Fallujah or Tal Afar. There were probably 4 or 5 cities where huge battles took place over weeks or months with American forces. And that's where, in the early phases, I think most of the violent death occurred. And so it was sort of out of sight of the press. By 2005 and 6, that had changed completely. Fighting between Iraqis had become the dominant cause of death. And so I think that issue of the coalition sort of being the driving force of violence has diminished over the course of the occupation very dramatically.
With that first study, you said that here in the U.S. it really didn't get very much traction within the media. Did you put effort into trying to get traction there?
Oh, yes. At Johns Hopkins, they created a press release like they often do when they have an important health finding, and they sent it to all the wire services and agencies, just like always. But a couple things worked against us. First of all, it was pretty close, just like a week before the 2004 election, and I think all reporters and editors look at things with a much more jaundiced, suspect eye when you're before an election. That's issue number one. Issue number two was, the U.S. government has become very, very good at manipulating the message. An example, a couple of reporters called up the Centers for Disease Control. It's our national epidemiological think tank, and said, is there anyone there who can talk about this Lancet study describing 100,000 civilian deaths? And the press office said, no, sorry, no one here can do that. But there is a statistician at Harvard who's familiar with the work, and they gave his name and number. That statistician wasn't sitting at Harvard. He was sitting at the American Enterprise Institute. And he had been a signatory on the Project for the New American Century, a set of proposals that, among other things, suggested regime change in Iraq before the second President Bush got into office. And so the press office at CDC knew exactly how to divert press inquiries to get out the message they wanted without anyone in the government like saying this is a bad study. In fact, there were a couple of people at the CDC who eventually got called directly by reporters. And they said, oh, this is the way it's done. This is as good as it's going to get in this sort of difficult to operate circumstance, and there's no reason to not believe this data. The most dramatic example of that was a fellow named Brad Woodruff, who was interviewed in the Chronicle of Higher Education a couple months after the study came out. And interestingly, because he was a federal employee, probably the most prestigious war epidemiologist in the federal employ at that time, a couple of congressmen asked him to come testify in Congress, and Health and Human Services refused to let him go. And they first asked the CDC, they said no. They went up to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, he said no. It turns out that's illegal. It turns out that Congress has the right of advisement of any scientific assets or researchers in the U.S. government. And Brad Woodruff and the couple of Ron Paul and the couple of congressmen that were trying to ask him to come didn't really realize that at that moment in time. The CDC refused someone else a little later on, and then that point came out. So the government did its job to control the message. Pentagon spokespeople said, no, it's not plausible, but didn't really say why. Interestingly, two spin pieces were written the very next day after this came out. One by a former Undersecretary of Defense, Anthony Cordesman, the other by Slate Magazine's sort of defense correspondent. His name was Fred Kaplan. And they both were almost identical in nature. They said, wow, look how imprecise this study is. That's just so imprecise as to be meaningless. Well, that was not really true. We were quite sure it was over 100,000. We just couldn't put a number on it. And we were very sure that it was up over 50,000. This is a time when all the press is saying it's 12,000. And this message, so imprecise as to be meaningless, just spread around the blogosphere and the right-wing talk shows like lightning. And that really, I think, helped diffuse the story as well. And most importantly, there's a weird thing has arisen in the press. And I think Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, was the most dramatic articulation of this I've seen, that to be fair and balanced, they need to have someone on one side of every issue and someone on the other side of every issue. And for example, when the second Lancet study came out saying 600,000 dead, I know the New York Times had to call about 10 people before they could find someone who would say there's a problem with this study. It was a cancer statistician in Texas who, to the best of my knowledge, has never worked in a war zone. And they called the chairman of international health at Boston University, and he said, oh, this is how it's done. And they called the head of health policy at the biggest NGO in New York City. He said, this is how it's done. So they only quoted one of them saying, this is how it's done. And then they quoted this guy saying, well, I think the way they analyzed it is very suspect, and it's probably even less precise than they say, blah, 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 blah. So they had someone saying it's good, someone saying it's bad. They've been neutral. And in the 2004 case, the first sort of leftist-sounding person to dismiss the study was a former Pentagon weapons targeter who worked for Human Rights Watch. And he was called by the Washington Post and asked, what do you think of this study from Johns Hopkins saying 100,000 people have died? And he said, I haven't seen the study. I don't really know anything about the study, but 100,000 sounds high to me. So they quote him saying, 100,000 sounds high to me. They caught him on a train going into work. He gets to the office, starts talking to his mates, sees the article. His colleagues who are more epidemiologically trained say, Mark, don't, you can't dismiss this study. It looks pretty good. And he never repeated it. Never, 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 never. But because he was the first person to say it, he was the one who was interviewed on NPR. He was the one who was on the networks. He was the one who was on CNN. And none of the primary authors were ever on to discuss the results of that study. And he never again said it. He just said, well, either way, whether it's 12,000 or 100,000, it's way too many, and we need to be appropriate. I mean, he said the right thing from his knowledge base. But having been the first one to dismiss it, he was the darling of the media. The most high-profile interview, I think, that happened in the U.S. when that study came out was my being on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! And that has a pretty small circulation, and it's singing to the choir.
Were you ever asked to appear before Congress?
Yes. Yes. When the second study came out, there was a congressional hearing. And I and Gil Burnham from Johns Hopkins came and spoke. And two other sort of political scientists came and didn't talk so much about our study, but just about the circumstances of violence in Iraq and the appearance that things were far more widespread than you would get the impression from the press.
To get studies into the Lancet, my understanding is that's a pretty prestigious magazine and there's a tight peer review.
That's right. So the way it works is you send in your manuscript. They have two ways by which it's reviewed. You can request an expedited review, which means it'll get done quite quickly, and they'll try to get a response back to you within a couple of weeks as to whether they'll take it or not. Or you can just get the standard review, which typically takes a month or two. They get the manuscript. The editors first look at it, read it, and see, ask, does this seem like good science? And does this seem like something that's worthy of being out there for our readers, something they're interested in? If it passes muster, which maybe about half of manuscripts that come in, or 60 or 70% probably do, it goes out to three or so reviewers. I believe our first one actually had five reviewers because it was so important and they were wanting to make sure that everything was right before they committed to publishing that first paper. And the reviewers came back and they had some very good technical critiques. In particular, it's a very esoteric statistical issue, but we had grabbed households in clusters and we had analyzed the data, and in the risk and the elevation of mortality estimate, they were saying we hadn't actually considered fully the effect of grabbing in clusters, so we went back and reanalyzed the data about a week after we had submitted it when this critique came, which came actually from the chairman of biostatistics at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, probably the most prestigious public health school in the world. And then we resubmitted it, and it looked okay, and so then it was published a couple weeks later. So when something has gone through peer review, it's quite different than being posted on a blog, or even arriving in Time Magazine. In Time Magazine, the mechanism by which you are sure the facts in there are correct is the integrity of the writer and then the editorial staff who oversee it. So here, you've got that same thing going on, but you've got, in essence, the best scientists in the world as deemed by the journal critiquing it. And when something's really important, they'll get chairmen of prestigious departments to be the reviewers, and they'll get people who don't have access to Grind and don't have particular agendas and have a lot of standing in their field. And that happened twice around in the Lancet study. And interestingly, the second round, because of all the gruff that had arisen after the first study, the article was published with an editorial that essentially explained what the peer review process was and how rigorous it had been in the case of this study, just to sort of remind the lay people who might go to a medical journal for the first time in their lives that this was not just a couple of hacks who wrote something up. This was something done by some researchers and critiqued by as good researchers as they could find before it was given approval.
So you've been working in this field for quite a while now, do you believe that it's really been in the last 8 years or thereabouts that the climate has significantly changed towards it's being receptive towards studies like yours?
No, I think actually it's gone the opposite way. I think that for things that have political importance, the spinning of information about war, about death, about misery, has become much, much, much more sophisticated. Not very long ago, the Centers for Disease Control went to Somalia, did some nutritional surveys, and in their nutritional surveys they noticed that when recording who lived in every household, there was, in, I think it was Baidoa, about half the children missing. And that was one of the primary things that triggered the first President Bush to send troops into Somalia. The notion that hundreds of thousands of children had starved to death or died of disease because of the anarchy that was unfolding, I think really pulled on his heartstrings. That was not peer-reviewed data. That was not even a study designed to look at mortality. It was designed to look at malnutrition. They just happened to record who was alive and notice that there just weren't enough kids. When we look at data that was collected in the Biafran War, that was then used by the U.S. State Department for its lobbying purposes, it was really shoddy science compared. But in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, and so a little bit of insight as to what was going on in Biafra was so much better than anyone else had that they would use it and move forward. And I recall running around in Bosnia doing an assessment for the State Department, and within days, our recommendation that more diesel fuel be put into central Bosnia because generators couldn't run at hospitals and water pumps couldn't run and cities were going without water because for lack of diesel fuel. President Clinton grabbed that, embraced it. You know, it wasn't a sample. It was a quick and dirty scientific assessment. And I think that we've seen in Colombia when some data came out that the government didn't like, in Darfur, where the Sudanese government has manipulated the UN and, for example, forced them to do mortality estimates at periods of time of low violence and forbid them to ask more than 3 months back in time what happened in the households when the interviewers spoke to the households. Governments have gotten better and better at trying to neutralize data. In this case, they manipulated the UN to produce numbers far, far lower than the NGOs had been saying about the death rate in Darfur. So, no, it's getting harder and harder, but the great news is that the human rights community, those of us academics who spend some of our time in the field trying to collect data and do work, we're getting better and better at what we do. And my sense is probably that the forces of human rights and social justice are getting better faster than governments are at controlling the message. If we think back to the Vietnam War, there weren't any interviews like this going on. There weren't any independent, non-government estimates of how many Vietnamese had died. The best estimate we had happened more than a decade after the war ended when a couple of demographers looked at the profile of who was alive then, who was alive before the war, and who seemed to be missing. So our only really serious academic estimates from that didn't involve U.S. government data were from a decade after. And so here we are, there have been at least 5 reasonably scientific estimates of how many people have died in Iraq over the course of the conflict, and they've always been many times higher than the press summaries would suggest, many times higher than the Iraqi government would suggest, and it has led, I think, to some more compassion for the Iraqi people than would have arisen otherwise. So, you know, the number of dead, that's just one aspect of the human misery that's unfolded there. And I think there are other groups working on providing services to orphans, working on displaced people who have shown up in the neighboring countries to Iraq. And they are, in their own way, trying to get the world to understand the misery associated with those problems. And thus we have a more sophisticated fabric of civility trying to curb the excesses of governments in times of war. So Governments are getting better at manipulating, and we're getting better at documenting, and in the race, I think we're winning.
All right. Thank you very much for spending time with us today.
The pleasure was mine.